I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's January 17th, and we have a lot to talk about. Today, we're talking about a topic that you've told me is the topic that you'd most like me to cover on this podcast. So today, we're talking about autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, or HSCT. And I'm dedicating this entire episode of Real Talk MS to my conversation with the man who pioneered autologous HSCT as a treatment for relapsing remitting MS. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Richard Burt. It's hard to have a conversation about stem cell therapy for multiple sclerosis without Dr. Richard Burt's name coming up. Dr. Burt performed America's first hematopoietic stem cell transplant for multiple sclerosis, systemic lupus erythematosus, Crohn's disease, stiff person syndrome, and chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy. And he published the world's first randomized stem cell transplantation clinical trial for multiple sclerosis. Dr. Burt has written and edited several medical textbooks, but unlike those textbooks, Dr. Burt wrote his new book specifically for people living with MS and other autoimmune diseases to put them in a better position to, and I'm quoting here, to know, to be informed, and to be equipped to decide. The book is titled Everyday Miracles, Curing Multiple Sclerosis, Scleroderma, and Autoimmune Diseases by Hematopoietic Stem Cell Transplant. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Burt.
Well, thank you very much.
I know it's going to help some of my listeners if you could start us off by explaining what a stem cell is, what a hematopoietic stem cell is, and what autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation actually is.
So thank you for that introduction. You're absolutely right. I wrote this book to help clarify some of those misunderstandings that exist out there. There are many types of stem cells. There are embryonic stem cells, there's neural stem cells, there's mesenchymal stem cells, and there are hematopoietic stem cells. So the use, the rationale, and the regulations around those stem cells all depend on the type of stem cell. So what I have worked with that people are aware of are hematopoietic stem cells. That's what I'll talk about today. I've also worked for a long time with IPS, induced pluripotent stem cells, where you genetically reprogram an adult cell back to an embryonic stem cell state. But I won't talk about that today. We'll just talk about the book and the hematopoietic stem cell. The other type of stem cells I really don't work with. So when people ask me to talk about mesenchymal or neural stem cells, I'm aware of them, occasionally read the literature in them. I don't work with them. And so I don't talk about them because information is valuable, but incomplete information is dangerous. And so even though I'm in stem cells, because I don't work with mesenchymal, I don't work with neural stem cells, I'm not up to date with them, what I would say could be misleading, as I have found from my own work when you do it yourself and people talk about it, whether they're in medicine or outside of medicine, I always have to kind of several times raise my eyebrows like, whoa, you know, that's not quite right. But it's because they're not doing it. They don't have the complete information. So going back to the hematopoietic stem cell transplant for autoimmune disease, I describe in the book how the idea came about. It was when I was a fellow at Johns Hopkins, how it was developed when I was a fellow at NIH with Johns Hopkins, working at Johns Hopkins, and then how we developed individual protocols for different diseases and how we had to learn from the results of one protocol for the next. Because one of the big confusions out there is that the hematopoietic stem cell is somehow therapeutic. It absolutely is not therapeutic. It has no neuroregenerative or oligodendrocyte regenerative effects. Zero. The only reason we give it back is to reconstitute the blood system. Why do we have to reconstitute it? Because we give about 5 days. It depends on the conditioning regimen, but for multiple sclerosis, it's 5 days of immune-specific drugs to knock down your immune system. Because multiple sclerosis is an immune-mediated disease, at least when it's relapsing-remitting. Later, secondary progressive becomes neurodegenerative predominantly, but relapsing-remitting is immune-mediated. So the conditioning regimen that I have standardly used, cyclophosphamide and ATG, are two drugs used commonly for all types of autoimmune disorders by many, many physicians. It has a long history of being used since the 1960s for transplant for aplastic anemia, which in most cases is an autoimmune disease, just treated by hematologists. So I just applied that concept for multiple sclerosis. I do, because it's non-myeloablative, which means it doesn't destroy the patient's own stem cell compartment in their bone marrow. It doesn't affect their hematopoietic stem cells. They will recover fine without infusing stem cells in them, but by collecting those stem cells from their blood before the transplant, collecting a small fraction of them and giving them back, they will recover about 4 days, 5 days sooner, making it safer. So you don't have to give them, but it's a wise precaution so they recover faster. And what they're recovering from is a pancytopenia. The drugs that you give for the to knock down the immune system knocks the entire bone marrow down for a few days, and then you're not making immune cells or red blood cells or platelets. And you can be supported through with red blood cell transfusions or platelet transfusions, which vary between patients. A rare patient doesn't need any because it's non-myeloablative. But you can support them with that, and then you support them with antibiotics till their immune system recovers, which happens usually between day 8 and 12, most often day 9, with this type of regimen. So the results of an autologous, meaning your own stem cell, hematopoietic stem cell transplant, depends entirely, almost entirely, on two things. The conditioning regimen you use to knock down the old immune system attacking your brain and spinal cord, and patient selection. So if you're selecting patients who have progressive disease, it's not going to benefit them because that's predominantly neurodegenerative. Obviously, you don't want to take people who are having very mild MS. I don't think the risk-benefit ratio would favor them. It's people who are having aggressive MS, and I can define that at another time if you want to know, or that is having frequent relapses. And that regimen that you use isn't standard for all diseases. You have to adjust it for the disease you're treating. So there's a lot of confusion out there. People say stem cell transplant, and they all think the same. That's like saying a disease-modifying therapy or disease-modifying drug and thinking they're all the same, thinking Copaxone is the same as interferon, the same as Lemtrada, same as Tysabri. They're absolutely not the same. Their efficacy varies and their toxicity varies. So that's what you have to key into, is the conditioning regimen. The hematopoietic stem cells that are reinfused are simply a supportive blood product to hasten recovery, much like you do for a patient in a motor vehicle accident. You give them red blood cells, it's a supportive blood product, or that's usually allogeneic, someone else's red blood cells. A better analogy would be a surgeon doing a cholecystectomy, removing the gallbladder. Oftentimes, they'll collect red blood cells from the patient before they do that procedure, and then right during or after the procedure, they reinfuse it, so it shortens your stay and can even be done as an outpatient, and off you go. The red blood cell infusion is not the therapy. The cholecystectomy is. It's just a supportive product to help you recover faster. And in fact, the hematopoietic stem cells are doing exactly that same thing. They're your own stem cells are a supportive product to help you recover faster. So that's where I think a great deal of confusion arises. And that also causes confusion because people think the FDA has to regulate it. And while that's true for many types of stem cells, it's not true for this. Because as long as it's a homologous application for normal physiologic function, it doesn't need FDA regulation. To say this requires FDA regulation is like saying a blood transfusion for a motor vehicle accident requires FDA regulation. It doesn't. It requires blood transfusion, normal type of regulations, because in reality, that is all it is.
In your book, you write that there are two types of conditioning regimens, myeloablative and non-myeloablative conditioning regimens. What are the differences between these two conditioning regimens?
Excellent question, and I've talked about this forever. When I first started this a long time ago, I was the original pioneer, and a lot of people thought it was too aggressive. I understand that. But as time went on, what I realized happened is, especially Americans pushed the myeloablative regimen, and they pushed it because of funding from National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease. I was actually had a big grant for them. I was number one in that grant. And I started really having strong discussions with them that you don't want to do that. I already had animal data. I already had human data. You don't want to use these myeloablative regimens that are used in cancer. The goal is not to destroy the bone marrow. In a myeloablative regimen, if you don't give the stem cells back, they're not going to recover. They're going to die. And they're just more toxic. So you don't want that. And I've been arguing that you have to do non-myeloablative. And so, it's fallen on deaf ears. So I just went ahead and did the non-myeloablative approach because it's much safer and it only makes sense. You want to reset the immune system. You don't want to destroy the stem cell compartment in the bone marrow. In leukemia, where myeloablatives are used, you want to destroy the stem cell compartment because it's malignant. It's a cancer. Your stem cells are not in MS or autoimmune diseases are not malignant. They're not a cancer. And in the vast majority of people with autoimmune diseases, they're not genetically set to cause that autoimmune disease. It's during when they become T and B cells and immune cells, they have to get educated. And that's what immunology is all about. There's multiple different types of cells and steps in that process that is being understood more and more. And there's recognition that there are effector cells, there's regulatory cells, there's cells that shut down the immune system, there's cells that activate it. But the point is it gets off of balance. It gets out of balance. And it, because your immune cells are long-lived, they virtually live with you your entire life, even though you can make new ones, the ones you have live with you your entire life, and it gets off balance. This is an attempt just to reset that balance by kind of wiping the slate clean, restarting your immune system, which can be done very rapidly. So the time that you're actually neutropenic is about 8 days, and then you're out of the hospital, usually day 9 after the stem cell infusion. And if you allow that reset with no inflammation around, and the drugs that are immune specific in a non-myeloablative regimen not only knock down your immune system, they stop inflammation. But if you allow the immune system to regenerate without inflammation, it will, on its own, reset towards tolerance to self. Now, that doesn't mean that someday in the future that tolerance could be broken, and because they're your own stem cells. And looking at this data now, though, in writing this book, when I was, because we haven't followed people beyond 5 years, and we find that, it's about 73% using this non-myeloablative regimen that I've reported remain in remission and need no more drugs, free of new evidence of MS with improvement in neurologic disability for up to 5 years. But in writing this book, I went back, contacted my first patient 21 years ago and patients between 10 to 20 years, and just randomly, now that's again not, I haven't done it methodically, but just randomly, everyone was still in remission, doing great. And of course, they don't want to come back and get MRIs or anything. They're glad to be free of the medical system and all those charges and expense and inconvenience because they're on no drugs, but they got better and they stayed better and they haven't needed drugs. And so, there's only 24/7 time available to me and so much to do, but maybe sometime in the future, I can go back and do a follow-up on all these patients beyond 10 years, because I was just really struck how everyone I called was doing great. So anyway, what I wanted to do is get that information out to patients, make them aware there is a difference between myeloablative. Those are cancer regimens designed to kill the stem cells in the bone marrow. Non-myeloablative that are immune-specific, designed to maximally reduce your immune compartment, but not your stem cell. It won't kill your bone marrow stem cell compartment. The only reason we give the stem cells isn't that you won't recover without them, but it's a blood supportive product to shorten that time of recovery, shorten your hospital stay.
Well, I want to circle back to some of those patient stories in a moment or two, but you mentioned that most American medical institutions use this myeloablative conditioning regimen, even for autoimmune diseases. What would they say is their reason for insisting upon this kind of conditioning regimen when we're talking about autoimmune diseases and not cancer?
Well, so I don't think there's anything malevolent in their heart or in their minds. I would say they have the assumption that the aggressive myeloablative regimens will give more durable remissions. And I don't, and I have data that is really, really good. So you got to, what I bring out of this book is then why jump to those myeloablative regimens? But I think that they're under that assumption. There's no data that they are better. They're certainly more toxic. They raise the risk of mortality, of other organ damage, and may in some cases even contribute to some neurodegeneration. So that is my concern. When we can do it with a safer non-myeloablative regimen, because that's the goal, reset the immune system, not destroy the bone marrow, then why go to those regimens? But I think that would be the underlying concept they would have that's completely unproven. It's theoretical, but I believe they might feel that way. And the other is they probably feel it's a better way to study regeneration immune system if you kind of nuke it all and start from zero. I actually oppose that concept because you nuke everything, things don't come back normal. Okay, that's literally true, and that's been seen in haploidentical transplants for patients with leukemia. The immune system doesn't quite return to normal, or if it does, it doesn't do it as rapidly, and it's also somewhat age dependent in its ability to recover. So I think if you can do it in a more gentle method, it's better. I think the immune analysis with a more gentle method on recovery may be a little different than when you totally nuke it with these myeloablative regimens. But certainly the toxicity is higher. And looking at how my patients have done and how I've reported it and even wrote this book, I myself, even though I started this field, have no interest in doing these more aggressive regimens. Now, if somebody wants to do it, that's their choice, but they need informed consent. And unfortunately, what's going on out there is that there's confusion. People don't understand the difference between myeloablative and non-myeloablative. And they talk like they're the same, and they are totally different. And of course, the other big thing is the selection of patients. If you're getting patients shifting into secondary progressive, it's not going to be as effective. Once they're secondary progressive, it's of no benefit at all. So all drugs, all surgeries, everything a doctor does has potential good and bad. It absolutely does. One of the things that I always say to young doctors who think everything's a miracle pill is if a patient comes in with a complaint, the first thing you do is look at the list of medications they're on. Not infrequently, it's iatrogenic. That is induced by the doctor's medication. And that's the same with these aggressive, that's the same with transplant. There can be complications short-term and long-term from the conditioning regimen. And when you use extremely intense myeloablative conditioning regimens, those complications short-term and long-term are even greater, depending, of course, on the regimen used. That's why I've even though when I first started this, nobody had thought about it, that people thought this was too aggressive, it's kind of such an odd turnaround of the chairs that I've been arguing against the aggressive myeloablative and in favor of non-myeloablative because I don't think it's necessary and because it's safer. And when you're doing something new like this, why jump to the most expensive and dangerous? Why, especially when you see the data we have, why not use a safer, less aggressive, less expensive? By the way, I talk about what the cost or charges are for non-myeloablative. A myeloablative, I don't mention them, but from what patients tell me, they're approximately double that. So as I mentioned in the book, it seems like the American default is towards the most expensive, most aggressive. And I mentioned that in the last chapter about talking about financial toxicity of our system. And that's because, that develops because doctors, for the most part, have no idea what the cost of these drugs or the treatment is that in terms of the impact on the patient or the comparative cost effectiveness with other therapies. And that's because we're not trained in that. It's because when papers are published, whether it's in the New England Journal or JAMA or Lancet or whatever, they a lot of times omit quality of life. That's a whole other issue. That's starting to change. But they definitely omit the cost and cost effectiveness of that therapy compared to other treatments. So it's been one of the things contributing to really excessive inflation in medical care compared to the rate of inflation for our economy as a whole. And so I bring out the last chapter, you know, how this has arisen, and that it's not malevolence on the part of any one individual. It's kind of how our systems developed, and that, you know, people are just following it instead of realizing you've got to keep tweaking things to improve it, because the ultimate goal is the patient in front of you. That's what's most important. And I'm just kind of think our system needs to be tweaked a little bit to reemphasize the patient. Again, I bring that out in the last part of the book. Oh, so again, let me emphasize these conditioning regimens. And it's an analogy I make in the book. It's like an astronomer looking at stars out there in other solar systems, and they're finding planets. And they're finding planets in the habitable zone. And so the conditioning regimen, that's what you want. You want the habitable zone. You don't want it too weak. It's not going to be effective. You don't want it too strong. It's going to be too dangerous for the patient with bad consequences and a lot more toxicity. So you don't, you know, life is not going to exist in Mercury. It's way too hot. It's not going to exist on Jupiter. It's way too cold. But in the habitable zone, which is Earth and Mars, life can exist. Now, when you look at planets at solar systems, the astronomers look to find planets in that habitable zone. But that habitable zone, where it is from the star, depends on the intensity of the star. So for a red star, which is not nearly as hot, it's closer, probably around the orbit of Mercury. For a giant blue star, it's a lot further out, maybe around Jupiter. For a yellow star like ours, it's where our planet is. And so, you know, the conditioning regimen you use is like that. You want the optimal in the habitable zone, not too strong, not too weak. And that's going to depend on the disease. Not one regimen doesn't fit every disease.
I can appreciate how important the conditioning regimen is. And I understand the point that myeloablative conditioning regimen becomes the default. I guess I'm curious. The doctors at these other institutions, they see a lot of the same data you see. They see the patient response to myeloablative conditioning regimens that you've observed. Some of these hospitals are considered to be among the best medical institutions in the world. So I get the default, but what's keeping them from adopting non-myeloablative conditioning regimens?
So one of the things I bring out in the last chapter, I bring out 4 points why this is hindered. And one of those points is homelessness. And why I say it's homeless is because there is no National Institute of Autoimmune Disease at the NIH. There is no NIH federal government support for institutes of autoimmune disease or departments of autoimmune disease. And so they don't exist. And the result of that is that this transplant for MS came out of the field of hematology oncology, where physicians use myeloablative regimens for leukemia. There is absolutely no such thing as non-myeloablative autologous transplant for a cancer. They're all myeloablative. So the people, the hematologists that have the skills to do this therapy, they're focused on myeloablative from cancer. That's how they've been trained. They do not know autoimmune disease. They're not trained in MS or other autoimmune diseases. The specialists in the Department of Neurology and Autoimmune Disease do not know transplant. It's all the same to them. So this area has ended up homeless. The reason I was able to do what I did is I originally started in the field of transplant for leukemia. I was a Leukemia Scholar of America because of the gene therapy protocol I did and so forth. But I gave all that up to develop this idea after years of animal models to focus just clinically on transplant for autoimmune diseases. So I had to become an expert in multiple sclerosis or CIDP or neuromyelitis optica or scleroderma or Crohn's. And, you know, to do that, I would spend usually 2 years reading every article and designing a protocol, talking to experts and so forth. Then I sat at the bedside of every patient. But that's not what's going on. You have specialists who are trained to do autologous myeloablative. The concept of autologous non-myeloablative doesn't exist in cancer. And you have other specialists that know MS, but they don't understand transplant. And I think That's one of the big reasons, homelessness. Now, how did this homelessness arise? I mean, I list in the book, I show a table of like 75, 76 autoimmune diseases. There are more than that. How did this come about? Well, it came about because of how medicine developed. So initially, we developed some specialties based on what we could see with our eyes. There were no microscopes. So there's dermatology, you know, the skin. There's ophthalmology, the eyes. There's cardiology, because at autopsy, you could see the heart. And then they figured out how circulation works and so forth. There's, again, pulmonary, because you could see the lungs, nephrology, because you can see the kidneys and so forth. But nobody saw these cells in the blood. Nobody knew what they were until we had microscopes. And then it took time, but they began to understand that there are immune cells and different types of immune cells that cause autoimmune diseases. And so that developed departments of immunology, which are basic research departments. But the clinical care of these patients had already been given to all these other different departments. You know, MS went to neurology. So there's never been development of a National Institute of Autoimmune Disease that would focus on this. And within this institute or department, there would be a cellular therapy center like hematopoietic stem cell transplant that's focused on that. And I think the reason I've been able to see this and get the results I've done, and the patients who, you know, have been with me or have gone through this are so unbelievably, you know, loyal, because it's so fundamentally changed their lives, yet people don't hear them, don't really see them. It's because of how they're trained. They're trained down these different slots. Now, to change that would require someone doing what I do, trained in originally in transplantive hematology, giving it up entirely, none of it, and focusing on an autoimmune disease or a couple autoimmune diseases. And nobody's done that except me. The other way to do it is that if the government funded a National Institute of Autoimmune Disease and reorganized this area. But cellular therapy and autoimmune disease is going to continue to grow. These, you know, results are important. That's why I wanted to write this label. Get this information out there to the patient, because they'll push it. But beyond stem cell transplant, there's other types of therapies like CAR T cells that are applicable to autoimmune diseases. In my own mind, I have one where I think it'd be perfect, because we know exactly what the antigen is that the autoimmune disease is targeting. It's not MS, it's another disease. So that area is going to grow, but it's going to remain homeless, which will inhibit its growth, just because people are in different silos. And when you get in a silo, you kind of see what's presented in that silo and how you've been trained. It's kind of like I say in my book, when I graduated medical school, I thought it was a great talk we were given at our graduating ceremony, commencement, in which she congratulated us for everything we accomplished, but then said half of what we were taught is wrong. The problem is we don't know which half. And that's kind of the problem. And so, education is great. I'm all for it. I've spent my life always trying to re-educate myself. I'm a professor. But education can also put blinders on people. And that's why whenever you're changing a field, you meet resistance from the elite in the field, because you're seeing things in a new way, in a different way. And that's why I bring out in the book, that's what research is. Research is re-searching. It's repeating the search at a different time with different eyes. And that's basically what's been happening here. But it's kind of having to change the way people see things. But because their life, those people doing transplants for autoimmune disease, is basically still stuck in myeloablative transplants for cancer, they're not making that adjustment. They're not focusing on just, say, MS, and it's a fault of the way the medical system has been designed. And changing that is something that's well beyond my capabilities to do. Just doing this, you know, at this point, a year ago, I wrote and rewrote, you know, almost every chapter to help the authors. Many authors wanted my name on their chapters. I said no, but my name is still on 15 of the 66 chapters. A medical textbook, this one, And that came out November of 2021 to help clarify for experts in the field, whether you're PhD or MD, what stem cell and cellular therapy is for autoimmune diseases. But unfortunately, despite doing that, despite all the talks I give, it doesn't take off. So I needed to get this lay book out, which I've done. And I must say in here, I do say that the MS Society has ignored this, and they have. But fortunately, they're coming around. Just the fact they're having you have me give this talk means they're coming around to this. They're warming up to it. They're beginning to see it. And I did send my book to every chapter president in the National MS Society because I want them to better understand it. But if finally, after getting this book out, if this doesn't change things, well, I will say I've kind of done everything I could do.
Well, in fairness, I have to say the MS Society has had a pretty significant part of their website devoted to autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation for a while now. But I want to kind of switch gears and go from the conditioning regimen to the other important criteria, and that is patient. Your book contains stories about a number of your patients who have clearly benefited, I'd say profoundly benefited, from autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation that you performed. And I think you point out that about 23% of those patients don't see the same outcome and they continue to relapse. What is it about those cases that keeps them from achieving the same sort of positive outcome?
So they do see it initially, but what I'm saying is that they'll relapse. Maybe it's 2, 3, 5 years out. The latest relapse I ever had was at 10 years. So the point is they do see it initially and they get better and then they relapse. And I mentioned how two of them, generally when they relapse, they're easier to control with drug therapy and do better. But what is it in those quarter of patients that will relapse? Again, initially they do get that same benefit that can last for many years. But what is it that causes them to relapse? I do not know. There's no predictive marker, and I wish I did know. Because then you could start, you know, in medicine it's important to tailor your therapy. Maybe then you could look at how to tweak the regimen for that subgroup. So honestly, I do not know. Every advance opens the doors, but raises new questions and new doors that you have to open. And that's one of those questions that I don't have an answer to. Nobody does. I can tell you that I don't want to do a second transplant. I was kind of forced by two patients who made me do it because when they came back, it was as aggressive as it was initially. It came back after several years, and they just refused to take any drugs, so they got a second transplant. I couldn't let them sit there with their brains on fire, so I did it. And their remission after the second transplant has been longer. They're many, many years of remission exceeding the first, which is called a remission inversion. And you do not see that in leukemia with myeloablative regimens. Your second remission is shorter than your first. So it's only an N of two patients, and it's longer. And again, my goal is a one-time therapy, after which you get better, stay better, and need no more drugs, and you don't relapse. But yes, with the regimen I use, 23 to 25% relapse rate. What has shocked me is that when I'm looking at them now longer, 10 to 20 years out, the ones I've talked to are still doing great with no treatment.
I'm going to talk about a couple of them in just a moment. One more question about this. You write that the most significant risk for death with the non-myeloablative conditioning regimen is infection. But I didn't find the mortality rate associated with this much safer procedure. Do you know what that mortality rate is?
Yes, I put it in my book, and I actually have published a paper. We published a paper in Journal of Neurology, and I referenced it in the book as well. It's also on my website. All my publications are on the website. And that paper had 511 patients in it treated with non-myeloablative regimens, both on and off study, everybody we did. And the mortality is 0.2%. A patient died of Legionella that was post-mortem discovered to be in the shower head and in the sink. It was in the water supply of the hospital. So, you know, that those things can happen.
You write about one of your patients whom you've named Barry. I should point out that sometimes you may be using the patient's name. Sometimes you may be using a pseudonym for them. So you've named this patient Barry. You indicate it's been 20 years since Barry's transplant, and following his transplant, he was able to go back to his 60-hour work weeks. He returned to coaching and playing hockey. He and his wife bought a house on a lake, and every weekend, he's out on the water, jet skiing, swimming, boating. And there's another patient, Andy, who had his transplant 15 years ago. Andy was a computer programmer, and although Andy's now participating in the MS 150 two-day 150-mile bike ride, he wasn't able to return to his job. You share a lot of hugely successful patient outcomes, and there are other examples of what seem like successful but less complete or less full restoration of that patient's prior function. Do you know what causes the differences between, say, Barry's complete positive outcome and Andy's most of the way positive outcome?
It's patient selection. So in other words, 10% of MS is primary progressive from up front, so we won't do those. I think those are predominantly neurodegenerative. 90% are relapsing remitting, so the vast majority are relapsing remitting. And over time, given enough time, they'll eventually transition into secondary progressive, which is neurodegenerative. So the longer you wait, the more time, the more drugs, DMTs they failed, and the more they enter into secondary progressive, the more permanent damage there is. Even if they're not in secondary progressive, there is still going to be some permanent damage that's not going to repair. It's remarkable that we get the repair that we do, because the stem cells don't cause repair. It's your own brain that repairs itself once the immune attack is stopped. That's what's going on. Now, it's like MS itself. You get a relapse, you go back to your normal baseline, relapse back to your normal baseline. You have a relapse, you don't recover all the way to normal baseline. You have to have some permanent deficit until the next relapse, where you may go back to that same permanent deficit or more deficit. If you do a transplant when there's permanent neurologic deficits that can't recover, those aren't going to recover. The remarkable thing is how much of it does recover. So that's an argument to do it sooner in the disease, rather than just continuing giving these drugs and allowing the patient to continue to progress, but at a slower rate than without the drug. Of course, the problem is you don't want to offer this therapy in someone who's going to do really well and have very mild MS from the beginning. I don't think the risk-benefit justifies that. But I certainly think it can be moved more up front. And where I think this should be considered with a non-myeloablative regimen, I put that caveat, non-myeloablative, or people who a neurologist would, upon first evaluation, there's so much activity, so many brain lesions, that they'd want to start one of these aggressive, expensive, well, they're all expensive, but aggressive DMTs like Lemtrada, or cladribine, or Tysabri, or Ocrevus. I think that's a group you can take up front to non-myeloablative. The other group we take are those who have just failed either an interferon or Copaxone, but have had at least two confirmed acute attacks in the last year, or have failed any more aggressive, you know, second or third generation DMT, but have had at least one confirmed attack in the last year despite those drugs. So, you know, you want to get it while still relapsing remitting. And the sooner you get it before it's had time to slowly cause damage and permanent neurologic disability, the more recovery you're going to get.
You know, some of the folks who are listening to our conversation are people who are living with relapsing remitting MS. Some of them are currently on one of the high efficacy disease modifying therapies, and to them, their MS is relatively well managed. How should they be thinking about autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation?
So I get people come to me like that all the time. And basically, if on one of these highly efficacious DMTs, they're not having new disease activity, that is no new acute attacks, no new lesions on MRI, we don't offer it to them. If it breaks through and they start having these acute attacks, new lesions on MRI, then we would reevaluate it and offer it to them.
You write that given their outrageous cost in the United States, 1 year of paying for MS disease modifying therapies would pay for the entire transplant when using a non-myeloablative regimen. Insurance companies are in the business of preserving their resources and basically building their profits. They're in the business of trying to find the most cost-effective treatments because it works to their advantage. So given the cost of autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation compared to the cost of almost any DMT, why aren't private insurance companies jumping on this and lobbying to see more of these procedures being performed?
Well, I think insurance companies, number one, they look at the initial upfront expense. They don't like annualize it over years. And actually, Profit in America runs that way. It's the quarterly report. It's not the effect over 5 years and the tremendous cost saving. It's what's going on in the quarterly report. But above and beyond that, whenever I bring that up with insurance companies, and we talk with every insurance company when we submit for insurance approval, go through pills if necessary, spend a lot of time. We don't ever charge a patient. We just spend a lot of time trying to get them to see how this benefits the patient, how it is appropriate, and how it could also help the insurance company. But whenever I bring up the cost effectiveness, they always stop me and they say, we don't look at cost. They all say that. I think that's true. I think they have been instructed for fear that they'll be accused of choosing the least expensive over the best treatment. They absolutely will not look at cost. They won't even let you bring it up. They don't want to hear it. And I think that they fear that they would then be accused of choosing something cheap instead of the best treatment out there. So that goes back again to my argument that we have to publish, you know, after a phase three study, kind of a phase four cost effectiveness, where you look at the cost and compare it to these other treatments out there. So it's in the literature. So people then have to deal with it and say, look, it's equally or more cost effective and it's cheaper. But because that's not there in the literature and because doctors aren't even aware of it themselves, it's not in their literature. I think insurance companies are concerned of being, if they incorporated that evaluation into their analysis, of being accused of choosing something cheaper instead of the best for the patient. So they just won't, they don't want it. Every single insurance company, when I bring it up, they say, we do not look at the cost of anything. And I, in approval. Now somewhere, somebody has to look at that. I think the committee doing that approval doesn't, but somebody does, because obviously for an insurance company, it's the shared resources of everybody paying to that insurance company to help someone who's ill. And if something's really expensive for one person, there's less resources available for other people in the insurance plan. And when you come to government healthcare, it's the same thing. It's everybody in society paying. But, you know, there's not unlimited resources in our government or in our healthcare system. So I think looking at cost effectiveness has been a big issue that has been dropped in our medical education, and that should be pushed. Again, it would probably change, require a change out of Congress instructing NIH that, you know, publications for that are, you know, should be pushed to promote as a final phase four cost effectiveness. Because I think that's really, really important. I do bring out one other disease we've treated had great results in. It is neuromyelitis optica, or DEVIX. It's confused with MS. It looks like MS, but it's like it used to be MS, but now it's a separate disease because they actually have identified an antibody that causes neuromyelitis optica. It's the aquaporin 4 antibody, and it actually targets astrocytes, not oligodendrocytes, but it gives a demyelinating disease, looks just like MS, except it's predominantly, initially at least, optic nerves and the spinal cord, and the lesions tend to be at least 3 vertebrae in length, whereas MS is usually just one unless it becomes confluent. But anyway, the first FDA drug approved, which was in 2019, is eculizumab. Before that, there was never an FDA-approved drug. And all it does is block the activation of complement. It doesn't get rid of the antibody, and it's $750,000 a year, $750,000 a year. And it slows the number of relapses. It doesn't prevent for sure that there will never be any more relapses, and you have to stay on it forever. And the antibody that causes the disease is still there. We showed in our transplant that we published in Neurology, now it was only 11 patients, but we showed that after transplant, 80% of them became antibody negative by 6 months, and all 80% of those stayed in remission with no drugs, no treatment for 5 years, with a one-time therapy of $125,000. The transplant for neuromyelitis is a little more expensive. It's a whole different regimen. Again, regimens have to be tailored for each disease. But that's compared one time, 5 years out, they're all in remission, no more drugs, got better, stayed better, versus $750,000 a year every year. So it's a tremendous cost savings. But nobody pays attention to it. And as I mentioned in there, there's a neurologist who I think very highly of, very astute, very good, excellent neurologist. But it's, you know, rituximab, a B cell antibody, can knock that titer down, be helpful for NMO just like it is for MS, but it doesn't eliminate the antibody, but it's a lot cheaper. But he said to me, you know, other countries that can't afford $750,000 a year every year for a patient, we'll use rituximab. America will use eculizumab. Well, again, that just shows how corrosive this is in our thinking when we're not taught to look at the cost for a patient and for society at a physician level. So I really take it back to the physicians. We're ignoring that. And unfortunately, more and more physicians are becoming employees of hospitals where the hospital gets its money from the work the physicians do, and they're pushed to increase their RVUs, their billing, so the hospital gets more money instead of focusing on the patient. And what we have to tweak in our system is to realize that medical care and psychological health suffer from toxic costs that patients cannot afford. And so we have to represent the best financial as well as medical interests of our patient. And as physicians, we're not taught to represent that financial interest. And in fact, it's going completely the wrong direction, with physicians becoming employees, being pushed to bill more and more and more to support the business structure above them that they're not a part of. And then they are rewarded at the end of the year with more, with a big check, because, you know, they billed more than was originally anticipated. And that happens. Believe me, it happens all the time. And that leaves the patient out of the equation. It's kind of like if you take your car to a dealership and, you know, you want the spark plugs changed, and it comes back with new brakes, a new gas tank, a new fuel injectors, new carburetors, you're going to, and the most expensive spark plug they could find that was made at some high, you know, profile place in Italy, for Lamborghinis, you're going to say, I'm not paying for this. But in medicine, that doesn't happen. So the system needs to be tweaked. That's beyond me. The only reason I brought it out is because I'm saying these are reasons why this isn't taking off. It's not somebody not wanting to help patients. Absolutely not. All doctors want to. But the way the system's gotten structured, together, they're prohibiting the advance of something that can be highly effective and very cost effective, and even telling patients about it so they're aware, or even understanding the difference between myeloablative and non-myeloablative. Very, very important. One's cheaper and safer compared to the other. And it's like, again, the difference, it's understood. Copaxone's different than Lemtrada, but when it comes to transplant, people aren't understanding those differences.
You know, I think you've made clear that autologous HSCT is a potential therapy for relapsing remitting MS. In your book, yes, you write that secondary progressive MS without enhancing MRI lesions, sometimes called non-active secondary progressive MS, will need a different stem cell with neuroregenerative potential instead of HSCT-induced immune regenerative effect. And you write that you're working on it. So I have to ask, how's that work coming?
Well, thank you for asking. And, you know, I worked for 10 years in animal models of MS to develop autologous transplant for MS. It does work in relapsing remitting, and it works not nearly as well, but it still works in active secondary progressive. That is, you still have new active lesions in the MRI in the last year. Once you're non-active secondary progressive, no, it doesn't work, and I won't offer it to patients with MS. My bias is that we truly need a neuroregenerative therapy in those patients. And so I've been working now quietly for the last 10 years in animal models, and we've actually have 7 U.S. patents using iPS cells to regenerate tissue, and have really just with an interesting tweak come up with a universal stem cell that can repair any organ system independent of your MHC. In our patents, I've given it the term transbiosis. I don't think anybody's ever used that term. It means transfer of life. And it's kind of a very sophisticated form of parabiosis, which was first discovered in 1864 by a physician in England named Dr. Burt, incidentally, but it's B-E-R-T. I'm B-U-R-T. And he tied the blood of a very young mouse to an old mouse and made the old mouse younger. The old mouse didn't make the young mouse older. Young mouse made the old mouse younger. So then that was kind of forgotten. And since then, there's been a lot more work done on it. There have been papers in Nature Medicine out of like Stanford and everything saying this is a real effect. Well, that's kind of what we've done with our iPS, except it's so powerful and we're not tying anybody's blood together. I call it transbiosis. I just presented this at a talk in Serum, California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. And they actually, although it's in the patents, they said, you really need to get this out in the scientific literature with your name attached to that word, since we kind of now are using that word and nobody else is. And I agree. But again, there's only 24/7 time available to me. But we've set up a company and we've had investment, and we are working to develop our IPS for treatments, and that's a whole different area, a whole nother set of problems. But in a sense, it's also at the bedside, it's just an injection of the cells, period. There's no chemotherapy, there's no hospitalization. So it's in a sense a lot easier to do, but there's a lot of other hurdles because that's a true stem cell therapy. And there's, we have to have a GMP, good manufacturing procedure facility available. You kind of gown up to go in and completely sterile and all of that. So we're working on it, and that's one of my big focus of what I'm doing. So HSCT for autoimmune disease was my first child, and I want to see it go forward in the right direction. I have no intellectual property rights to it. I'm glad to help anybody. I publish all this. I'm glad other centers do it the way I do it. I get no license out of it. I just want it to help society, but I don't want it to crash and go in the wrong direction with these dangerous myeloablative regimens and selecting people that are active secondary progressive instead of you can do it there and help them, but you really want to focus, get them earlier. So that's still my child that I want to see grow up right. But I have a new child just waiting to be born that I'm focusing on. And over this year, we'll spend a great deal more of my time on that IPS in the hopes of getting it to the patient's bedside. And the first two would probably be non-healing ulcers, cutaneous, so easy, just inject and take pictures, see how it gets better. And the other would be neurodegenerative. Now, where neurodegenerative will go with that, that would be something that we're still discussing. But again, there's certain hoops there, and God willing, if I live long enough, have enough support, I'll get there. And then there may be a second edition to this book with the IPS.
Well, that's exciting. The name of the book is Everyday Miracles, Curing Multiple Sclerosis, Scleroderma, and Autoimmune Diseases by Hematopoietic Stem Cell Transplant. Dr. Richard Burt, thank you for your work, your advocacy, your commitment, and your passion on behalf of people living with MS and other autoimmune diseases. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/281. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free RealTalk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of RealTalk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episode. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.